Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we've got Dr. Kathleen Lutz, Vice President of the Rare Disease Translational Center at the Jackson Laboratory, who discussed a recently published study on the potential of STATHMIN-2 as a specific biomarker for patients with ALS. In this episode, Lutz provided commentary on her research, the models used, and the role STATHMIN-2 and TDP-43 play in this patient population. In addition, she spoke on the next steps in furthering this research and whether STATHMIN-2 may be incorporated in future clinical trials. Let's dive in.
Known a lot about, or have learned a lot about STATHMIN-2 in terms of some of its function. We understand that there is missplicing in the absence of TDP-43, which is a common mechanism that we see in ALS. And I think we also knew that STATHMIN-2 was required for looking for axonal regeneration. So when you cut the axons in the absence of STATHMIN-2, you don't get regeneration. And that was data that was published. And so the information around STATHMIN-2 was around really axonal regeneration. We know that STATHMIN-2 is concentrated in the growth cones of the axons. But I think what we didn't know is what was the role of STATHMIN-2 in terms of ALS aging, and the maintenance of the overall axon. So we knew it was required for regeneration. We know that it's involved in, the split missplicing is involved in ALS, but we don't necessarily understand the mechanism of how, you know, STATHMIN-2 is operating in the context of aging in ALS.
So let's talk a little bit about the specific findings themselves. So can you provide for our clinical audience a little bit of an overview insight on some of the top line findings that you observed from the study? What did we learn more about STATHMIN-2 and also TDP-43 and things of that sorts?
Yeah, it was a little challenging to address the question in mouse models of STATHMIN-2 depletion and missplicing. And it's mostly because STATHMIN-2 doesn't appear in the same context in mice as it does in humans. And that is, you don't see the cryptic splicing in the mouse model. We have engineered recently, and we published this data already, mouse models where we've humanized that part of the sequence that the STATHMIN-2 will function, you know, as it would be seen in the humans. And we're really looking forward to looking at those mouse models in the context of TDP-43 depletion. But for this study, we really focused on STATHMIN-2, and if we were to take multiple approaches to the depletion of STATHMIN-2 in the mouse models, what would we see? So there were a number of different ways we did this. We did this with transient ASO expression. We did it with an shRNA in a subpeel injection, essentially into the spinal cord, something like an intrathecal injection, but a little bit more specific to the gray matter and motor neurons. And then, of course, we made the STATHMIN-2 knockout animals themselves. And then the question is, you know, what do we see over time? What do we see with transient or complete loss of STATHMIN-2 in the mouse models? And it was interesting to see that it was in the subpeel and in the transient, we did start to see, you know, signs of axonal problems, if you will. It wasn't really clear if we were going to see problems at the level of the motor neuron, but we know that the motor unit at some level is affected. And so what we demonstrated in those experiments with the ASO and the shRNA is that with STATHMIN-2 loss over time, you don't necessarily see a lot of impact on the motor neuron itself, but it's the axons that seem to be affected. There's a collapsing of the axons, if you will, the diameter, the caliber, is much smaller. There's some demyelination that occurs. The neuromuscular junctions, you know, are not necessarily the way that you would expect in a normal animal model. And so we are seeing signs that depletion of Stathmin-2, transient depletion of Stathmin-2, will provide you with, over time, not immediately, but over time, signs of what we would see as a progressive sensory neuropathy and also a motor neuropathy as well. It doesn't necessarily appear instantaneously, but in a lot of ways, ALS doesn't either, right? ALS is a disease of aging, and it's probably a number of insults over time. But we do know that in the face of TDP-43 mislocalization, Stathmin-2 missplicing is one of the major events that you see at the molecular level. So trying to understand how Stathmin-2 is really affecting neuronal health, axonal health, and how it might fit a little bit more mechanistically into ALS, I think was the point of these experiments. Of course, we did a knockout, you know, as well. And that was relatively interesting as well, because it was a constitutive knockout of Stathmin-2. And of course, we did see in animals on a BLAC6 background, we saw a lot of lethality, interestingly enough, giving us some indication, at least on the context of a BLAC6 background, Stathmin-2 was necessary for the animals to live. But some of the animals, the majority of them died at birth, but some of them survived. And for those that survived, you know, we saw deficits again in rotarod and what would be considered to be motor and neuromuscular deficits. Interestingly enough, if you cross those animals to an FEBN background, you get much better survival, but still the deficits are there.
Well, it's interesting, and you talked about kind of some of the differences between the mouse models and the humans, which kind of brings me to my next question. So a lot of great research and got a lot of great translational research that we have here, but how do we sort of take the next steps and what are sort of the next steps after this, after learning what we're learning from this study?
I think what we are thinking of in terms of the holy grail of these mouse models is a model for ALS where we see TDP-43 mislocalization. And most of the models that we have, that doesn't necessarily occur, like in the C9orf72 mouse models or the SOD1G93A mouse models. We've looked at a number of FTD granulin mutations. We've looked at TDP-43 transgenic animals that have really nice deficits, but we're just not seeing nuclear loss of TDP-43. So our next experiments that are ongoing now, and we're really hopeful that these are going to work, and I think that our evidence, you know, suggests that they are to take conditional TDP-43 mouse models where you deplete TDP-43. So there's automatically a nuclear loss of TDP-43. In that context, in the face of a humanized Stathmin-2, we absolutely see missplicing. And in that way, we have now a model that we can, you know, think about restoring the Stathmin-2. But the constitutive models or the conditional models, rather, are only going to be, you know, proof of principle, so to speak. And we're also working on different mouse models where we can get loss of nuclear TDP-43, maybe in a more native state in the context of the disease itself.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Lutz to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on January 3rd, the FDA cleared Caverna Therapeutics' investigational new drug application to test KYV-101, a CAR T-cell therapy, in patients with refractory progressive multiple sclerosis. The approved Phase 2 open-label trial will target a large patient demographic to evaluate the efficacy and safety of the agent in this patient population for which there are limited therapies available. On the same day, Dyne Therapeutics announced initial data from its Phase 1-2 DELIVER trial of Dyne-251 in patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy amenable to exon 51 skipping. All told, the therapy was safe and with a compelling efficacy profile that was comparable, if not better, than standard of care eteplirsen. Less than a week later, new 18-month findings from a Phase 1b trial showed that AB1005, an investigational gene therapy for patients with Parkinson's disease, met its primary objective of safety with feasible administration to the putamen. Study data are expected to be presented at a scientific meeting next quarter, while planning for a phase 2 trial remains ongoing. And finally, on January 8th, newly announced data from the long-term extension phase of the pivotal Visionary MS trial showed that treatment with investigational CNM-AU8 resulted in improved progressive vision and cognition in patients with relapsing multiple sclerosis. Full results of the long-term extension will be presented at the upcoming ACTRIMS forum. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Lutz.
There was one thing that stuck out to me was that this sort of impacts neurofilament light dependent axoplasmic organization. It's a mouthful right there. But considering the fact that, you know, tofersen was approved on neurofilament light chain levels earlier this year, I'm just curious what that finding, what that meant for you, whether that stood out to you, or if that has any impact, or how it works just in comparison to the fact that we did have an approval based on that kind of level, which I know neurofilament light is across a lot of neurodegenerative disorders, but I'm just curious what your reaction was to that finding specifically.
Well, I think it's really important. As you mentioned, neurofilament light chain is a fantastic biomarker that we follow in the patients, just like we follow EMGs, electrophysiology, but to have a fluid-based biomarker, I think is really important. And so much about what we know, what we're learning, I should say, in the clinical trial designs. And I think tofersen was a fantastic example of that, of maybe just not waiting long enough in the clinical trial design to see the effects. Some antisense oligonucleotides for FUS mutations that Neil Schneider and other people are developing are also showing neurofilament as a very predictable and reliable biomarker. So as you mentioned, there's a lot of neurological diseases where neurofilament light chain is just spilled in a pretty consistent and robust manner. So in this respect, you know, we're thinking that this is, you know, pretty much in line with what we've been seeing, and nice to know that it's there.
We've talked a lot about the potential of this, and do you believe that this could be a sort of quote unquote disease modifying biomarker of sorts? I know we use the word disease modifying a little bit too much in today's society for some things, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are, and you know, what we'd have to do obviously to get to that step.
It's an interesting question, and I'll say I don't know the answer to it. You know, certainly what we've seen in the face of TDP-43 nuclear loss are a lot of changes in RNA splicing and the transcriptome. We're very hopeful that the mouse models, with some additional humanization with ONC13A, sortilin is also a player in this. You know, will Stathmin 2 restoration, you know, be enough in terms of an antisense oligonucleotide example, for example, as a therapeutic? Will that be enough to tilt the scales, if you will? Will we need to modify, you know, other components within the cell? I think is an ongoing question, but I think we're headed in the right direction, and certainly, you know, the ASOs I think have been, you know, the with SOD1 and with FUS have just been, as you said, amazing. It's almost revolutionary, if you will, to finally have a therapeutic that is so specific for a particular form of ALS and so impactful. Not to say that it's the only therapeutics we have for ALS, but they're certainly incredibly robust in terms of their mechanism of action and how we can follow them.
Obviously, Stathmin 2 has kind of gained a little bit more attention over the last couple of years. And this may be a little bit too much of a preliminary question, but do you ever envision that ALS clinical trials, drug development specifically, will ever incorporate Stathmin 2 as a potential biomarker of sorts? You know, I know obviously tofersen was approved on neurofilament light as a sort of surrogate, but I'm just curious if this would ever to be introduced, or is it not feasible enough to kind of be introduced?
Yeah, you know, it really is that the fluid-based biomarkers, you know, are a little bit easier, you know, to get a handle on, and certainly neurofilament is spilled in the plasma, and so it's easier to follow. The The effects of Stathmin 2 as a therapeutic are interesting. As a biomarker, I'm not sure. I think people like Bob Bowser and other folks would probably have a stronger opinion on it. But certainly the biology and the mechanism of action and how it affects ALS, I think all of these things are incredibly interesting and things that we as the ALS community and researchers have to tackle.
Dr. Lutz, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention about this research specifically? Any notable points that we didn't touch upon that you feel might be worthy, I guess?
Well, I think, a couple of things, and one is just the contributions of the collaboration that I'm working with Clotilde Langerin and Don Cleveland. It's just a wonderful, fantastic group of individuals. They themselves have been wonderful to work with, their laboratory students, postdocs, and researchers. Putting our heads together collectively, I think, is always stronger, than a single person. And then I also, would like to just say that, all of the mouse models that we're making and all the mouse models we have made are available to the scientific community, through the Jackson Laboratory. And we think that this is an important contribution, Other people need to have access to these resources. They need to replicate, reproduce, and perform more experiments. And so we're really happy to have that resource available to the scientific community. And we hope, as a collective, we do good things.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.